generation computing project. I was the officer in charge of creating new advanced artificial intelligence applications for clandestine operations. And so I was looking at linking people in text, you know, so that if you need a, if you need someone, you know, when you do an audio operation, you need a safe housekeeper so that, because you've got like a 200 to 500 meter path loss thing, so you got to have a receiver real close. So how do you identify a safe housekeeper who is known to someone, who is known to someone, who is known to someone who already works for you? In other words, how do you find a path between people? And I did all of this stuff. And I realized that the fifth generation project in Japan was worth penetrating. So I went to the Japanese desk in the DL and I said, hey, I've gotten real smart about computers and what's worth stealing and all of this stuff. I said, how about I learn Japanese and I go penetrate the fifth generation project? And I said, no, not interested. You know, we really don't care about computers. Okay, I guarantee you Walker was not a CIA operation. Among other things, we don't like 18-year-olds with no college degree. You know, I'm fairly certain he was, like my friend here, independently inspired. And
basically, I could go to Afghanistan now if I had the money and just try and join a terrorist group.
You'd run the risk of, number one, being shot. Number two...
Why wasn't he shot?
Because he was for real. They're not stupid.
He wasn't for... Wait a minute. How can they tell whether you're for real or not?
You prove yourself. I mean, one of the problems we have is that we're not allowed to handle people who kill Americans. And one of the first tests for somebody is go kill an American. Show us you're serious.
So basically, he killed an American.
I'm not saying that. Look, I've spent 10 years, and after this 10 years, a number of you, I think, are willing to believe that I'm not working for the CIA and that I'm kind of pretty much what I say I am, a reformed spy who really believes in open source intelligence and network citizen stuff. I guarantee you, CIA would never fund me to do this. Now, for the last 10 years, I have run a conference which brings out anywhere from 150 to 800 foreign spies and intelligence analysts to talk to each other about open source intelligence. It's an absolutely brilliant concept for bringing people out and creating new relationships that are outside the official liaison thing. CIA has historically not attended my conference. Okay? And in fact, the FBI has really screwed me over because they were cold pitching my foreigners in their hotel room. Some of my Eastern Europeans were going back into their hotel room and finding an FBI special agent sitting in on their bed waiting for them. So I lost a lot of my audience to bullshit like this. You know, if I had known it was happening at the time, I would have sued them. By now, it's burnt bridges, spilled water.
What do you think of these companies that are paying the FBI and CIA just to tell them that there's going to be terrorist attacks when there's not? Just to sell a product? Like,
I have no idea. I think you're way over the top on conspiracy theory. Next person. No, actually...
You're not an ex-person. Maybe I should be a... No, stop.
But let me tell you this. The U.S. government is being very, very stupid about how it's spending its money. And yes, a lot of companies... I mean, I don't know if you've noticed, but the day after 9/11, there were a whole bunch of Homeland Defense Analysis Centers that had never existed. And these are cretins that didn't know about this beforehand, and they're just selling the government bullshit. So the taxpayer dollar is not being spent very wisely. Now, I want to, I'm going to ask, you do your question, and then Andy, I want you to ask your question again.
Yeah. But by the way, did you listen to Jalal mentioning your efforts?
No. Oh, no, because I frankly intended to listen to the whole thing, but I got tired of him talking about being screwed over by his friends. So I finally walked out.
I guess he mentioned a very similar point what I said, and that's, I mean, the question obviously is, where do you take the trust from that if you enforce the United States government to get a better information processing and a better ability to understand what's going on, where do you take that trust that they use this for the, let's say, peaceful solutions of problems for the whole human race and not for only for commercial, you know, reasons whatsoever. I mean, what's actually happened is they go to all kinds of countries where, let's say, the ability of the government to act with the citizens is not nice. And they come with arguments like, we need human rights, we need democracy, and so on. And it all sounds very good, but what they mean is market regulation, what they mean
is
privatization.
I mean, wait.
what I mean is privatization of telecommunication.
Privatization of water.
Everything, yes. So, again, where do you take the trust from that this government, you know, with the just, I mean, there's two points here. The one is the tools they use, and the other is the direction they go to.
Part of the problem is that both government and industry are founded on the premise that the people are dumb and not connected and basically don't need to be consulted, and mm-hmm. and that the most efficient way to manage the affairs of society are to have a group of elites that do all the thinking for you and that basically are in charge of common resources like bandwidth and so on. Mm-hmm. That's history. Because now what we have is a smart people who is increasingly connected and able to make its own informed judgments.
But they don't have the possibility. I mean, wait a moment. We already have a situation of patents. We have a situation of, I mean, huge amounts of power being concentrated at single points of the planet.
And that's what we need to change.
And yet, yeah, right. But the question is... I mean, you have this kind of people that make the decisions. They're not going to say, oh, you kids out there, oh, you
Andy,
grow up now, you now have better understanding, oh, now you can grow with us.
One of the things...
You don't have to be on the Eichen board to see that only that you're there and that only that you also understand the issues means that you really can make decisions with those guys. I mean, it's a little bit naive.
Look... popular boycotts work. Consumer power works. Votes work. When you get
votes work in the United States. Who elected your president? Who elected your fucking president? I mean,
yes. Hey. See, one of the interesting things.
I mean, was he elected?
One of the no, he stole his brother. Yes, it works. Corporations respond. In fact, a lot of people have discovered that it's better to go directly after the corporations and not even bother with government. Now, let me answer your question in two ways. The first is, I believe we need a lot more foreign language, foreign cultural insight on our decisions. One of the problems that we have is Americans really, I mean, I can't even talk about these issues with the adults that are in my Boy Scout troop, because they actually believe what the Missouri Synod believes, which is that these people are all pagans and that we can't respect them. We can't even pray with them. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod just fired the president, like an archbishop, for having done an interfaith service with Muslim clerical leaders. Okay, we have Americans out there that really believe that the rest of the world is basically an annoyance and that we should simply swat them like a fly. And they don't realize that these guys now have asymmetric power that can bring down America. So what I think, Andy, is number one, I think the Internet is going to make it possible to create a public intelligence agency. And I think that public intelligence agency will be multicultural in nature. For example, when East Timor or Indonesia falls apart, I expect that the Internet Task Force on East Timor will have a Dutch contingent, a Portuguese contingent, an Indonesian contingent, an Australian, a Philippine, a Malaysian contingent. And out of all of that will come a higher level global intelligence estimate. And even if there are disagreements, they can be footnoted disagreements.
But let me ask you this question. I mean, I have a concrete example of what's going on. I have a deaf German hacker called Tron. You know, he was involved in some chip card stories. He was involved in an Israeli company owned by a guy called Robert Murdoch. Who wanted to hire him, but he didn't want to work for them, but it's a long story. At the end of the day, we found him dead. And, you know, we have some investigation running for a few years now because police say it's a suicide. Technically, even the medical people say it can't have been a suicide, but that's not important. Important is I have his parents around. I have, you know, a huge involvement of all kinds of interesting government, including the United States government. I have his mother asking me the question, she asked me, you know, when all these NSA people here make the decisions about what German government does and what not, why can't we vote the American president?
And I mean, that's the, in a way, it's the right question, because you look at this here from an American perspective. You're asking yourself, wouldn't it be a good idea our government understands other cultures? But for me, it's the other way around. It's why is the United States government the central place? Yes, it's the fuck up place, but why is it the central place to make kinds of decisions about other governments? Why shouldn't this be a completely decentralized environment?
I think that, number one, it is an indictment of the American people that Gore didn't have the balls to really go the whole distance. Now, personally, I think Gore would not have been a great president, nor is George Bush a great president. But according to Gary Pabst, who wrote a book called The Best Democracy That Money Can Buy, he's an investigative journalist for The Observer and other English newspapers. He's an American expatriate. He discovered that 50,000 people had been disenfranchised in Florida because Jeb Bush pursued a very deliberate strategy of inviting felon lists from other states, including Texas, and then paying a company $3 million for what used to be a $400,000 job to disenfranchise anyone whose name had an 80% match. Okay. So they disenfranchised 50,000 people. Of those 50,000 people, I think roughly 35,000 were able to get their vote reestablished because they were able to go in and say, look, I'm not a 3-foot dwarf with one arm that you think is this felon. And oh, by the way, in Florida, only people convicted of a Florida felony are supposed to be disenfranchised. So Jeb Bush acted criminally and against the best interests of the American people. And I'm just stunned that he hasn't been held to account for this. I hope that he is never allowed to hold national office.
Even if it was, his brother would give him a pardon.
Well, that's true.
You're right about, I think the American people have the same empathy you do about either Gore or Bush was the right choice, so oh well.
Well, that's right, and I'm reading Nader's book now, Crashing the Party, and he's changed my mind. I used to think of him as a spoiler who denied Gore's the election. But he, as he says, it was Gore's election to lose. But more importantly, I think Nader's book really documents the fact that the Republican and the Democratic parties have both sold out completely. They are totally lock, stock, and barrel corporate entities. And I think the American people are smart enough now. I think that Lind and Halstead in their book on the radical center, there's another book called The Cultural Creatives, which is about 50,000 people that basically think of all the Oregon and Washington folks that are into sustainable economies and all of that. I think that movement's growing. I don't know if Nader's going to be smart enough to get a coalition of Greens, Reform, Libertarians, and Independents. But if he were smart enough to announce a team in advance that included people like Sam Nunn, who is himself a third party. I mean, Sam Nunn would love to run a third party. Fred Thompson, Colin Powell, who has been seriously disrespected in this administration. And I'm surprised he's putting up with this trash. He's the only guy there that I think has real ethics and integrity and a real understanding of reform. No, Colin Powell should have run for president this time around. As best I understand it from people inside his staff, the reason he didn't run for president is because when Rubin was assassinated in Israel, his wife, who has a nervous condition to begin with, flipped out. She had like a nervous breakdown. And she made him promise that he would never run for president because she was afraid he would be assassinated by right-wing zealots or whatever in the United States. Personally, I think he'd be a great president if he had a strong team around him. He does tend to be a little bit too corporate in his nature. I mean, he made it the tough way inside of the existing rule system. Questions from anyone? My personal answer is no. My personal answer is that I would vote for Colin Powell if he were to run, period. I mean, among other things, it would break the color barrier on the presidency. He is a man who earned his place in life the hard way. I mean, from the inside by the stupid white men rules. You know, that's another great book, which is if I hadn't read Greg Pabst's book first, I think I would have blown off the Stupid White Man book as just kind of, you know, publicity type stuff. But it tracks with a lot of other very serious books. Yeah, yeah. It's good reading. It's what I call airplane reading. It's whose list? No. Really? I'd be glad to get an email from you, bear@oss.net. But let me finish my comment here. The Stupid White Men book, there are a lot of books that really track with what he's saying, like Lionel Tiger's Manufacture of Evil. One of the interesting things about Tiger's book is he looks at how the industrial system broke down the bonds of kinship that used to keep people honest. You know, in other words, when cottage industries were kinship based, you basically had a circle of trust. And when you then turn that into an industrial machine, you basically broke that circle of trust. And it got to be, you know, buyer beware kind of stuff. But it tracks with a lot of other books. All right, your question, sir.
Okay. The phone call was running again, all right? Could you possibly, I mean, I know he's Republican?
Yes. I honestly don't know. I mean, you know, it really depends. If his wife were to die, I believe he would be liberated. Because I think, you know, no, I mean this in a very respectful and caring way. He is an honorable man who loves his wife and who is respecting her wish that he not place himself at risk of assassination. I'm quite convinced he's a very courageous man, and that if he did not have the concern over his wife's condition, that he would run for president. I hope he would run for president. I'm concerned. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's one of the issues. I think we need a strong American alternative media. One of the points that Nader makes in his book is that if you don't get into the presidential debates, which are now controlled no longer by the League of Women Voters, they are now controlled by a private corporation that was created by the Republicans and the Democrats for the specific purpose of blocking third-party candidates from being a part of the debates. And Nader makes the point in his book that if you don't get into the presidential debates, you don't reach millions and millions of people that you will never be able to touch, no matter how assiduously you campaign. So I personally believe that the American citizens should insist that the League of Women Voters, and also, but Nader makes the point that there's nothing to keep other debates from taking place. The big problem is attracting the two main contenders, because they have learned that if they deal in sound bites, they get by. And so what the American people need to do is say, we are going to have no less than 6 debates on substantive issues, and each candidate must publish an issue paper on water security, food security, public health, energy, education, citizenship and immigration, and national security. So roughly 7 issue papers. Everybody should be required to publish on the web an issue paper. And then I'd love to see America go back to citizen focus groups and neighborhoods and the whole bit. But right now the American voter is not taken seriously, and they've brought it on themselves. Yes, sir.
I'm not really... I'm sorry.
My name is Javier Garcon. I'm from Tallahassee, Florida. Some of you that don't know.
You're one of the victims. Okay.
Yeah, I drove 1,400 miles straight.
That's a long ride. How many hours?
14 hours. Yeah. And I made it to New Jersey to a friend's house. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of new at this, and it's freaking me out now with the speakers. The biggest, not the biggest thing, but some of the things that bother me is the Republican, the Democrats, and those are the only two you always see.
We need a third choice.
Yeah, and probably a fourth choice.
Well, and I'd even go so far as to say, first off, I think we need to change the voting system so that they do have the instant runoffs, which means you should be able to select a first choice and a second choice for president. And then if your first choice doesn't win, your votes go to the second choice. So that's something that every citizen in the next congressional election should be asking their candidates for Congress, saying, will you commit to doing this as legislation? That's a litmus test.
At this point, if you took every eligible person in the U.S. to be president and threw them into a lottery pool and drew one person to be president, would that person...
No, and part of the reason is that no one person is capable of doing the job. And one of the things I think the Americans need to realize is that who is a cabinet secretary really matters. Rumsfeld, for example, is Secretary of Defense. He surely has the best of intentions, but he is helping run the country into a major deficit. And the Pentagon should have been limited to its existing budget and forced to make trade-off decisions. The State Department needs Colin Powell, but he needs more money. For example, I think my dream would be for Nader, Perot, and Pat Buchanan to agree, and Sam Nunn, to agree to run as a team and to approach Colin Powell very discreetly through someone he really trusts and ask if he would allow his name to be entered as someone who would either remain as Secretary of State for an indefinite period or who would become Vice President or whatever. I think America is ready for an independent team to manage the country. I'm also, frankly, concerned about term limits. I think we actually need to eliminate term limits for a team. The world is getting too complicated for us to have neophytes in office. And so I don't know what's going to happen. Yeah.
I just wanted to get exactly to the timing issue as well. There's a book called Blowback.
Yes, excellent book.
What's his name?
Chalmers Johnson.
Right.
He was a very famous scholar of revolution.
Yeah, and I guess he explains 11th of September and everything quite well, and that also, of course, raises the question how much time the United States government still has to improve a little bit.
If I had to guess, I'd say
We
have between 3 and 7 years.
That in Europe, of course, it's assembly discussed. If, you know, we have, for example, this international court in Den Haag, you know what happened. And the United States comes there and says, oh, international court for criminal war, yeah, that's
Andy,
a good idea, but we ask for immunity.
What happened is,
hey, let me explain the issue and then my question and then you give the answer.
I already know the answer.
No, you're a little bit too fast because this is a very America-dominated discussion. And let me give you 1 minute of how from Europe this all looks like.
It looks like shit. I already know that.
It looks not only like shit, it looks like this needs some help from outside the country. Because how many years you ask us to wait from a European standpoint if we set up something like a Den Haag international, jurisdiction thing, and then United States ask for immunity, and then if the Den Haag people, the Dutch people say, wait a moment, no one gets immunity.
We're talking
about criminal activities here, and then United States says, okay, then we're gonna, the Dutch court will just put one American citizen into prison, then we're gonna send the Marines.
Look,
and, you know, from a European standpoint, we ask ourselves, oh, okay, they are insane. Let's forget about talking with them. They are insane. So I mean, honestly, give me the answer. Where to take the trust from that you're going
to
be able to
hear the answer
to your government?
Ago. Okay. Can I give you the answer?
Yeah.
Okay. Andy's my hero and one of the people I trust. I'm quite serious about that. But he does go on. Okay. Now, first off, I actually brought this subject up with some of the adults in my Boy Scout troop, and I was stunned by the answer, which really showed me a lot that I didn't realize. The guy looked me right in the eye and said, we can't do that because the International Tribunal will be stacked with third world countries that are out to get us. That was his answer. Okay? Now, that is probably the perception of enough Americans so that the government will not feel compelled to really accept this. But it's kind of a circular problem because there are a lot of third world countries that very rightly believe that we are a threat to their prosperity and security and that our corporate consumerism, I would distinguish between the American people who have very big hearts and corporate consumerism which is as we have seen with some recent exposures, really unethical and greedy and absolutely against the best interests of the American people, and government, which is somewhat divorced from the American people, somewhat beholden to the corporate system, generally with the best of intentions, but way, way out of date, completely lost in terms of new ideas and access to foreign information that's relevant. And so what we're really talking about here is a 25-year project to re-educate America and to get back in touch with the real world and to change our government at the local, state, and national levels. This is not easy stuff. And I don't know if it's going to happen. I really don't. But I have three boys. And those three boys are going to have children. And those children, I hope, will have children. And unless we start doing what the Native Americans call seventh-generation thinking as a community, our grandchildren and our grandchildren's grandchildren are going to be in deep shit. Yes, and one of the interesting things is kids are growing up with wired brains. But the education system is not doing very well. Someone smarter than me said that we've spent 100 years creating schools to build dummies. I mean, basically, our schools beat creativity out of people. No, I mean, creativity is beaten out of you in school. And then when you get to a corporate job, you're expected to be, we literally have to change the whole paradigm. And I don't know what the answer is other than people deciding they really want to come together in a critical mass. And I'll tell you something, the day that citizens realize how much power they actually have, holy cow. Because you're talking about instant recall of senators being thrown out of office overnight by a massive statewide vote that basically says, you're fired, asshole. You know, I mean, there's a lot of power to be had in the people. Yes, sir?
How can you have a state vote?
I think every state is different, and I don't know the details, but my general sense is that 300,000 signatures will get you a referendum. Some... Well, it's really challenging. I mean, one of the interesting things about Nader's book is how difficult it is to get these signatures. What's that? Crashing the party. Yes, sir.
Grassroots.com. Grassroots.com.
Grassroots.com. Physical. But let's just agree that the issue is still confused. But I do believe. No, but see, if you get to the web, if there's a couple of other books that are really interesting. One's called Imagine, What America Could Be in 20 Years. And it's a really well-done book with really good photography. And all of these books are in the bibliography of my second book or on Amazon.com. If you've got an hour and a half and a couple of beers in you, just go through my reviews. Just click down through 294 reviews. It'll take you less than 1 minute per review. So 294 minutes. Okay, and it'll really give you a good bird's eye view, among other things, of my opinion, but of these other books by other authors, because what I was trying to do was build a porthole into a really full range of national security books. But if you can get organized at the neighborhood level, you can use the web to basically say, okay, we need physical signatures, boom. You know, it's just like a telephone calling tree. In the military, you know, you call one person and they call two people and then that cascades down. We just haven't gotten organized. But there's no reason why we can't get organized at the neighborhood level. And that goes to kind of a random thought that there are certain themes that run through positive visions of America's future. One is campaign finance reform that is absolute, that basically trashes the corporate ability to buy legislation. The second is restoration of neighborhoods. We need to restore neighborhoods both in urban and rural suburban areas. It's amazing how much of America has been done by developers in ways that are not child-friendly. I mean, they can't bike. That's right, they're car-friendly. So we need to restore neighborhoods. But beyond that, if you restore neighborhoods with respect to food and energy, you achieve some very remarkable things. And one of the things that was in this book that really impressed me is that the Norwegians, among others, have gotten to where they've gotten industrial production down to the neighborhood level, even for extremely complex things. So it can be done. The two books that I recommend in this vein are The Cultural Cultural Creative. I have no idea. I have no idea. Question.
I'm going to get off a little subject here. I know you're probably all tired about September 11th, hearing it over and over and over again.
It's going to be with us for a long time.
This is my biggest question, and I contemplate because I'm a little morbid on it, okay? And you have to be. I know there's a lot of people that died and everything. Did America get anything out of it? I mean, did America prosper from the destruction? If it never happened.
No.
In any way.
No.
Money-wise.
I helped Amy Ziegart. Amy Ziegart was Condi Rice's doctoral student, and she wrote a book called Flawed by Design, The Origin of the CIA, NSC, and JCS. And that book got the Alfred White Award for being the best political science dissertation in that year. And Amy came to Washington, and I helped her get a bunch of interviews, and she got others with help from Condi Rice and so on, including John McCain, who said out and out it was an intelligence failure. But one of the people she talked to, and she shared this with me in an email afterwards, said we need another 5,000 body bags. I outraged Fox and Friends, the cable program, by saying that there's no war on terrorism. We're not at war. We're not really waging a war on terrorism. Washington isn't changing anything about the way it does business. I call the Senate Select Committee for Intelligence at 9:10 in the morning, and no one answers the phone. You know, what 9/11 cost us $20 billion in immediate aftermath effects on the economy. It's costing us $1.2 billion a year for our Afghan presence and our military. It's costing us a national deficit that is rising very rapidly. Each of us owes $66,000 right now for the national debt. It has cost us, because of the nature of the Bush presidency, it has cost us whatever potential it might have had for transforming the way we do business. For example, in my first book in the President's Chapter, which you can download for free from OSS.net, I say, among other things, that we need a Secretary General for National Security who has complete authority over justice, diplomacy, foreign aid, and the military. Basically, you have to be able to make trade-offs between hard and soft forms of power. We also need a Secretary General for the National Commonwealth, who can be in charge of energy and health and education and all of these things. Because what's happened here is we've got too many stovepipes in government. And we need to add, I think, a layer of dominant coordinating authority just below the presidential level. So that's one of the thoughts. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. I'd like to hark back to a question I asked last time. I know we were a bit rushed.
No, we're not rushed now.
We're not. Okay, so we do have plenty of time now. I don't think I understood your response. I'm not too good with all the political details. Okay. I know a little bit.
Let's try it again from the start.
Okay, from the start. Sounds like a good call. As a hacker, I understand what you're trying to do with this open source initiative on like open source information is trying to get everyone involved and have an open framework for creating all the stats. But, I mean, from the technical point, which I understand the best, that's the part that makes the most sense to me, that's the part I can understand, there's just a whole lot of data.
Yes, and okay, good. I'm really glad to have a chance to go over this again. There's three kinds of data, digital, analog, and unpublished. Okay?
Right.
So, that's number one. Number two, the data, regardless of its code or its media, so whether it's audio, visual, whether it's PAL, or NSC or whatever, any one of these data, whatever, forget those technical details. It's going to be in 29 different languages. Those are the 29 that matter. And then there are actually 3,000 languages spoken today by very small, diverse groups. But let's say 29 languages.
I mean, okay. I understand the enormous diversity
of
that.
That's huge. I'm not suggesting that we digitize all of that. And I'm not suggesting that we process all of that. What I'm suggesting is that we have nodes of human expertise that are multicultural and diverse that basically set themselves up as portals for screening that data and selecting that data and selectively processing and disseminating that data and selectively analyzing that data to create a common currency, if you will. And so what you end up doing, taking Indonesia as an example, is you end up creating a distributed cell where the Dutch Intelligence Service, which has real equities here, and the Australian National University and Australian Intelligence Service, and perhaps the Malaysian Intelligence Service and business community, they share the burden of screening stuff and digitizing and putting it into the web. And then essentially you're able to draw on diverse distributed resources in order to dominate this data.
I mean, I guess that sounds interesting.
And you'll have competing views of the data. You'll have competing versions of reality.
You'll have multiple countries.
Absolutely. And my vision in the end is that I can enter... Let me quickly do this. We've got plenty of time. There's no rush, okay? My vision is that eventually I can say, enter a question about the Spratly Islands and select the Chinese, Vietnamese, Philippine, and Australian point of view for that question. And then thereafter, as I'm interacting with the question, the digest of their view of that answer comes up, so you actually see four completely distinct cultural perspectives on the question you've asked. Go ahead with your question, which I'm sure is related. And we're coming back to you. Well, that was Roth's point, which he was very concerned that if we, say, created, let's say, an environmental website, that then corporations would flood it with disinformation and false analysis and stuff like that. I think we can get around that by having a physical trust presence established. You know, well, when actually there was a very big editorial in the Post, and my wife is beating up on me on this subject because this is right, empowering the people, and you know, he Jella was saying that every time corporations put a roadblock in, you know, some teenager finds a way around it. When Peter Black published his article in Wired back in like 92 or so. He was severely criticized for giving the terrorists a playbook, you know, a game plan for taking down America. And Wynn Schwartau and I have been criticized for writing publicly about how to take down America. Well, I'm of two minds on this, I've got two thoughts on this. The first is that you cannot defend America if all of the citizens aren't aware of the vulnerabilities. And basically, using open information is more empowering to the defender than it is to the attacker, because that's my view anyway. And second, if you keep these deficiencies secret, they'll never get worked on. I truly regret that another 9/11 will be required, but the American people who have been reading assiduously, I mean, the fact that I am reviewer number 70 on Amazon.com and I only review serious national security books, you can have three spy novels in there. But that says something about what Americans are reading. They've been reading about terrorism and Islam and all this stuff, and Americans are now engaged in the concept that there's something we don't understand that can really threaten us. However, Americans are too inclined to trust the government to do the right thing at this point. And as a result, we have a government that, with the best of intentions, is wasting billions of dollars and precious time, which cannot be recovered. Time is the one thing you can't buy back. And so in my humble opinion, with the best of intentions, the U.S. government is screwing up big time in terms of getting us ready for the long haul. Go on now.
Going back to how you presented your open source information initiative, I mean, the part that refers to America specifically sounds like what America is doing right now. So, I mean, that does seem like the best way to go about things. Mm-hmm. Of course, to have specializations in particular fields, and I imagine that's what they do now.
But see, the problem is that the specialists aren't being listened to. For example, when the U.S. government makes a decision on Afghanistan, they haven't actually read all the Dari, Pashto, and Farsi information to begin with. So they really don't have a good base of the historical, cultural, and current environment. That's number one. Number two, your core analysts responsible for Afghanistan are generally kept too busy answering stupid questions from senior officers to actually do any reflection. And so they're basically forced to generate reports and stuff like that. Number three, we don't have money in the budget for paying experts. And so, for example, while the Afghan task force may be able to call on two or three Afghan experts, there's actually one, I forget his name, but he wrote a book called Sources of Conflict, which I trashed because it had no index, no bibliography, no footnotes, and was very American-centric. He said the future of Asia will be determined by what the Americans want to do in Asia. But basically, he is the authority on Afghanistan for the National Security Council. They don't look any further. So we're not doing what I chose as my motto, which is harnessing the distributed intelligence of the whole earth. And that's what we need to use the web for. Right now, the web is a large garbage can with all this distributed stuff, but no one has put in the next layer of filtering and analyzing and source validation. And so what we need to do is take the web to the next level of sophistication.
I imagine that between the 30 days between the response to September 11th, people like Condoleezza Rice or Rumsfeld or Cheney were actually talking to these specialists.
Dream
it would be their
on.
Duty to talk to
it
these
specialists.
It
didn't happen. It didn't happen.
That would seem to me more to be a failure of these particular individuals rather than the system that...
You know, there's a rational...
systematic...
There's in public administration theory, and I'll come to you in a second, there's in public administration theory, there's a guy who invented the concept of, or discovered the concept of satisficing. And you have the rational model of decision-making, and then you have the political model of decision-making. Well, rational loses every time. These people are making decisions based on their domestic constituencies, their agenda for being reelected, and who they already know from the corporate world. And I will tell you, the guy that's helping the president understand Afghanistan is a loser that wrote a really shitty book called Sources of Conflict. Zali, I forget his name, but if you look up Sources of Conflict on Amazon.com, you can see my review of the book.
Probably not too well.
No, actually, I don't write negative reviews. I've written, I think, three slams. Most of my reviews... First off, I buy a lot of books. I buy about $6,000 worth of books a year. And I'll buy four books for every one that I'll review. And I'll only review it if I think it's really good and should be promulgated to others. The reason that I chose to slam two Rand publications was because this is a taxpayer-funded institution. And their editors are simply lazy. They're not willing to do indexes, which are extremely valuable. The people writing the RAND products were intellectually lazy and not doing footnotes and not doing a bibliography. And the information was very badly presented. And I chose in a very two specific instances to spank RAND publicly. And I don't know if it's had any impact on their publication since then, but I have been told by RAND employees that I was dead on target. And in fact, the individuals who did those two books were not respected within RAND itself. So we got to clean up our act. Think tanks are very bad right now. Universities are very bad. We are impoverished intellectually. And that's separate from the fact that we don't talk to each other in terms of, I mean, Afghanistan should be a national town hall meeting.
go on.
Okay. I guess my second question would harp back to implementing this on a global scale.
Mm-hmm.
When you already have allies spying on allies to see if they're what they're doing, and also distorting their information to their own purposes, how could we trust an expert press from Israel who have different interests from us in this particular situation than we might have on our own? How can we trust their information, or perhaps someone from
I'm not suggesting blind trust. You know, when I always enjoy going to France because the French are big on industrial espionage. And every time I'm in France, I say, I want you guys to spend all your money on industrial espionage, because that's not where the return on investment is. The return on investment is on open source, the best return on investment. You still need spies and secrecy and all that, but you really need to seriously think through diverting 10% of the money we now spend on spies to open source foreign language intelligence. Did you want to make a comment or elaborate on the question? And I'm coming back to this. I really want to take my time. And then we'll keep it. That's a good question. I don't know. Comment? That's right. That's right. We're set up a baseline. I agree, and I think that one of the ways, first off, let 1,000 points of light bloom. I mean, the web actually gives that meaning. And in any given country, you're going to have your leftist experts and your rightist experts and your anarchist experts. Let all that happen. Over time, I mean, the Amazon.com system for rating books has, in my opinion, created new value. Because I find the reviews very useful. And I find the grading system relatively reliable. I actually make decisions based on the reviews that are there. And I would say every system, one of the things we need to do is add more self, more validation to everything.
Isn't your point more of information rather than necessarily?
Well, the next level up is in fact trust, because nobody has the physics, the time to read everything. And so you're going to have to rely on one another at some point. Yeah, I tell you what I want to do. I want you to step aside for just a minute while I answer these two questions. And in fact, you can come sit here with me if you want. You know, and then I want to come back to your thing, because I really want to dissect this and carry on. Let me get your two questions real quick so you're not standing. And then we'll come back to this.
I deal with information myself, a lot of decision making, and the idea of open source, I've actually seen agents that were sharing certain amounts of their information and that were sharing more information that, let's say, other agents were more successful in their jobs, and they were actually benefiting their people and their governments more. And also, I think we all have to understand that there's a great level of emergence in self-organizing systems.
Yes.
So
yes.
There's a lot of things that neither me nor you can know, but that will start happening as any hacker in this room.
It could explode.
And it will explode. I'll make it one question because we're short on time. You say you read 6,000 books.
No, I said I spend about $6,000 a year on books.
I
probably read about 200 books a year.
200 books. And society, especially in America, but other societies are getting there. We're getting a division with people watching television, people going online. And it's actually a good thing because gets the lazy minds out of the way.
Yeah, but they don't have to be lazy. I mean, we don't have to have a corrupt educational environment. We don't have to have a corrupt media environment. But go on to your question.
I was going to ask, and I've asked you before, but we went more the political way. Could you, there's a certain movement in science called decision-making theory.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, and the problem is it's been corrupted by technologists. Decision support in the traditional IT framework, this is another, and CIOs are usually tech weenies rather than knowledge officers, okay? But decision support is way too biased right now toward automated decision support stuff. And they always assume that the data is both digital and available. Okay, none of the modeling and simulation systems that the U.S. government pays for, by and large, are based on real-world, real-time data. They're all, you know, this manufactured, shoveled shit that is a very small universe of data, and it has absolutely nothing to do with being connected so that it could actually model stuff in real-time based on real data. And it generally doesn't deal well with anomalies. And so, from my point of view, intelligence is really about decision support, precisely about decision support. But the theory and the practice hasn't caught up. For example, corporate executives are not held accountable for making informed decisions. And there are no metrics for establishing whether a strategic business decision to invest X million of plants in, and so forth was actually supported by business intelligence research. And these are the kinds of questions that stockholders need to be answering. There need to be information audits. There are four quadrants in my information world. The first quadrant is the so-called knowledge management quadrant, which means make the most of what you already know. And most corporations are mired in the database aspect of this, and they haven't really graduated, although some of them have graduated to Rolodexes and biographies so that you can find an expert based on keyword search and so on. They're really generally very insular and parochial. The second quadrant for me is the collaborative work quadrant. That's where you start getting into people who are wired, who have personal brands, who have Rolodexes, and they have a personal reputation, and they actually know who knows. I mean, I can do amazing things by email because, A young Marine captain in the Pacific Command called me up one day and he said, my colonel just told me I'm in charge of open source intelligence and I don't know what that is. And he found me. I own 85% of the hits on open source intelligence because I've got so much free information, which is another point. Information is a magnet. And the hackers in Silicon Valley, and I talked about this once, and one of them came up with they said that for every piece of information they volunteer or share, they get 100 back, 10 of which are useful. So that's a 10-to-1 return on investment. Also, bigot lists or distribution lists are out of date the minute they're written. Okay, and so you have to have an open system that allows flexibility. Now, going back to...
So essentially the practice of decision-making and...
We need to standardize it. So the second one is collaborative work. The third one is external information. And Peter Drucker, the guru of business information, said in Forbes ASAP on August 24th of 1998, on page something or other, he said we've spent 50 years focusing on the T in IT. We need to spend the next 50 years focusing on the I in IT. And he said the next big revolution is going to be in relation to content and knowledge and how you deal with the substance of it all. Most corporations are screwed because they have chief information officers that are technologists. These guys don't know how to ask the intelligence question. They don't know how to get the sources. And one of the problems we have with sources, Factiva costs $2.95 every time you crack a document. Okay? That gets expensive real fast. And so we need new forms of metrics and new forms of dialogue between the source providers and the processing providers. Because right now, to do it properly, automatically, it's too expensive, which is why I devised a system whereby I have an analyst that spends 4 hours, and we will use automation, just normal automation, I don't have anything fancy, to screen 2,000 relevant items, and we'll get that down to 200. And of those 200, a human analyst will read the subject lines and first sentence and make a decision on which 20 documents to crack.
So you bring it down automatically to 10%.
Exactly right. And that saves a lot of money. Because if you cracked every one of those documents under an automated system, you'd actually have a lot of false positives. You'd have a lot of trash in the system. One of the ugly things we found out is that retrievalware eats your homework. We would do very complex selections from Factiva, Dialog, and LexisNexis, and then it would be fed into retrievalware, and because of arcane issues, retrievalware would lose one-third of what we had found, okay, when it came out the other end. So I don't think there's a replacement for the human brain right now. So to end, my bottom line point here is that intelligence needs to become like accounting, not like corrupt accounting, but just like everybody has to do expense reports or trip reports or whatever, intelligence needs to become part of every decision process. And you have to learn that the proven process of intelligence really matters. Asking the right question. Okay, go on. If they pay money. Yeah, see, one of the things people don't realize is that the internet is very, very shallow. If you look at how much information Dialog has online that is filtered, edited, paginated, structured, reliable, it's 100 times what's available on the internet. One of the problems with the internet is that most information is undated, unpaginated, unsourced, unstable, you know, you get what you pay for. So we're just at the beginning of this revolution.
So to get a gist of your method, it's usage of existing information.
What's that?
To get back to your quadrant.
Okay, so external information is the next big revolution, because most people are basically making seat of the pants judgments, and they're not really doing the homework. Okay, nor are they being held accountable for not doing the homework. I actually have one success story, because see, one of the problems with the research, Anita Jones, when she was head of research development engineering in DOD, had her people call me, and they brought me in, and they said, how much would it cost for us to track through open source intelligence the relevant critical technologies, of which there are 100? And I said, for $1 million a year, I could do a really decent job. Okay, and really it boils down to about 100,000 per package, but then you can further divide that so that the analyst is actually doing 5 or 10 items on a different week. I found that a week is the right periodicity. Anything less than a week is too much. You can't see the change. Anything more than a week is you miss signals. Okay, so we do open source intelligence reports on a weekly basis. But here's a success story. Oh, and then going back to this whole DOD acquisition thing, we don't actually do our homework. I mean, in very rare cases, we don't go look to see if someone else has already built this. Now, special operations needed a man-portable roadblock, and this is a success story. And so they went to the Beltway Bandits, and the Beltway said, oh, yeah, we can build you some out of titanium, $250,000 each, whatever. Well, they did an open source. SOCOM has a good open source intelligence capability. They did an open source search, and they found that the Norwegians had already built one. And it was a really neat thing with teeth that rolls up in a coil, and you just pull it out and snap it across the road, and it pops right up. And it takes out, you know, any gauge tire. That was a success story, but we don't do that. I mean, DARPA invests millions and millions of dollars in data visualization stuff that has absolutely no relevance or has been bypassed by industry already or whatever. We're just out of control. It's very scary. Let me get the question from the next person, then we're going to come back to unpacking this more complex one.
Okay, I'm a programmer, so instantly I get an idea and I start thinking low level.
You're not obese and you don't smell, at least from here. Are you sure you're a real programmer?
Well, I try to be. One of the things that I'm seeing that I heard you mention before is what we need is not only sources, but analysts. In Linux documentation, you have this great thing called how-tos. And basically, it's taking somebody who has basic computer skills of a certain set and can bring them up so that they can fully understand some arcane aspect of it. You know.
Yes, that's exactly the thing that we need for distance learning.
How can a document like that be written? Can it be a digestible thing? Can we get the first chapter, something that somebody at working at, say, like one of the IMC organizations can post on their website, and they can put that as another aspect of the content they provide to people?
I think the answer is yes. I mean,
In your opinion, so we could take somebody who knows how to read and write and say something and bring them out in 30 pages or less and say, you know, they can analyze to a certain extent.
Well, let me put it in a different way. Let's take a typical country. In a typical country, you're going to have some personalities, and you're going to have some issues, and you have some capabilities. And there's no reason why, over time, we can't create one-pagers on each of those. For example, we did 166 out of 200 outstanding biographies that one of our clients had for Latin America. Basically, they wanted standard Defense Intelligence Agency biographies, and we were able to do 166 at a cost of less than $250 each through creative use of the internet and commercial online searching, a very streamlined process, to include photos where they were available. We'd scan them in from newspapers or whatever. Mostly criminals and terrorists, which are harder than normal political figures. Yeah, that's right. But my point is that over time, for example, the University of Texas does some very good stuff on the Zapatistas and other things. I believe that over time you can have a template where a specific group of people who is already paid for, whether it's faculty, students, a public interest group, or whatever, take on responsibility for country X. And they then create a website that takes it to the next order of magnitude or order of sophistication, which is they do a weekly open source intelligence report that is cross-hatched. So you would have, let's say, Colombia, and then you'd have political, military, legal, sociological, economic, ideological, cultural, demographic, technological, natural, geographic. These would be standard categories. And the beauty of this is that the web would then be set up so that if you're interested in the demographics of Latin America, you can put in an inquiry that pulls those demographic paragraphs from all of the different country reports done by different people. So it's a distributed intelligence system that is maintained by differing groups. And over time, competing groups will establish different types of trust and confidence. But where we've gone, where we need to go, I think, is we need to add the next layer of analysis, the next layer of focal stuff. And then also, we need to seriously revisit lifelong learning. Our schools don't teach what we need to know about the world today. Our newspapers don't publish what we need to know.